The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. He maketh me lie down in green pastures. He leadeth me beside the still waters. He restoreth my soul. He leadeth me in the paths of righteousness for his name's sake. Yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I take a look at my life and realize there's nothing left. Welcome back to Bookwave, the book club podcast. I'm your host, Scotsley, joined today by William.
Hey, guys.
And Jason.
Hey, it's me here doing this.
So that was just a little taste of one of the Psalms mixed in with a little bit of a Coolio verse. So if you're new around here, you can check us out at our website at bookwave.club. You can join the Discord link in the bottom. Like, comment, subscribe, share with all your friends and family. But today we're looking at the Book of Psalms, or we're going to start to look at the Book of Psalms, because this is going to be a multi-part series for this section of the Bible. But going onward with our Holy Bible Book Club, what effect did reading the first little section of Psalms here have on you guys?
Well, for starters, I think it grinded our Bible podcast right to a screeching halt. I think we were all pretty confidently marching on after a year and a half getting through the Bible and analyzing all of these stories and myths and tales, and everything was all happy-go-lucky. And then we hit the Psalms and it was like, oh, this is the meat and potatoes of the book. This is the thing that you need to understand. This is the thing you need to experience and immerse yourself in. And so for me, like, I didn't get anything out of reading any of the Psalms that I read. And I read them. I've read a third of this Book of Psalms. I've listened to a third of the Book of Psalms via audiobook a couple times, and nothing sank in. You know, like, I have been on quite the journey with this Bible. I've decided I believe in God. I've decided I'm not Christian, or any of the denominations of sort of active religion in the world, but I think God is real, and the more literally you take it, the less I believe in what you're talking about. So it was hard for me, because these are the Tehillim, right? These are the songs of praise to their Lord, and it's these ritual, ceremonial songs that are talking about the ideals and the towards and the way froms of this specific religion. And I just wasn't getting anything out of it, being in my own head, interpreting these words on my own time. So I went to church and I experienced the sensation of people singing in a room about how great God is. And that helped me a lot, because I hadn't even thought of looking at a mass in at least a decade. And so the whole singing portion of it had escaped me. You know, my memories of church were potlucks and Sunday school and old people that happened to be my doctor and were in the room when I came into the world, and the community that had been around me my whole life that I wasn't aware of. That's what I remembered. But the singing portion, like, I was a kid. I wasn't around really for the songs. I was going and watching VeggieTales. But that's what church is. It's like 40 to 60% of it is singing with a group of people for a week. And when you sing with a group of people that you identify with, it's really empowering. And it's so important that you do that. If you're going to have any sort of religious sense, you need to expose yourself to a group of people that you can like and resonate with, and literally increase your resonation together. Because that just changes something in you and your worldview at an unconscious level. It's hugely impactful.
Yeah, and I just, like, leaping off of that, I kind of tried to look at the Psalms through that lens. Like, this was their music, and, like, music is such an important part of my life. Like, the concerts that I've been to have changed my life. All of the music that I listen to is, like, an integral part of my day. And when I hear you talk about, like, just singing in church, it makes me think about, like, me and like two or three other guys just driving down the highway, all singing like whatever song pops up on the playlist together, right? And that does something for you too. It might not be as powerful as, you know, a room full of you know, almost 100 people or more all singing the same song about like praising God and actually talking about how you live your life. But when you think about how much music has changed your life, then you have to think about how much this music has changed their life, like the people that read this every day or the people throughout history who only ever had this and didn't have like radio play at all. They just, if you want to be musical, you praise God. And they're kind of the same thing, and they go together hand in hand. And once I started thinking about it that way, it kind of really started sinking in, because I was doing the same thing when I was just reading the words on the page. I was like, okay, praise God. God kill all of our enemies. God does this for us. God did that for us. We're going to do this for God. We're going to stay loyal to God. This is already like just a regurgitation if you're just reading it as like poetry. But when you think of it as this was their music, this was their canon of like from Hendrix to Zeppelin to Black Dahlia Murder, this was all they had. This was their music. This was their radio play. What do you think about that, Jason?
Yeah, I think we're all kind of on the same page. Like when we started reading Psalms, for me, it was a drag to get through. And then I realized that it was like these ecstatic songs. You can remember back in, I guess, Kings and Chronicles, how David would dance around and he was very ecstatic. And there were, you know, parts of when I went to church, that was the most enjoyable aspect of the hymns. And there were two psalms that I noticed in this kind of the first books. I think it was Psalm 4 and, let's see, 28, that I recognized a couple of the hymns that we would sing in church. It was Psalm 4 and 31, where the author said, let your face shine down on me and I will rejoice and be glad in your steadfast love. Those are like parts, hooks of the hymns that I remember from, you know, a decade ago singing with the congregation. And there is something to be said about that kind of group musical experience where it almost transcends you, your spirit, to a higher level, right?
Yeah, and absolutely.
What I found interesting about this, though, is that prior to these writings, because we've been reading book by book in the Old Testament, and a lot of interesting things have happened, and then we get to these part, I think you called it the Ketuvim, well, the writings portion, where it's a little more subdued, things are slowed down a bit. But before all this kind of as a precedent, there were these similar songs from Zoroastrianism. I think they were called the Gathas. And so I see the structure and the content of these psalms kind of mirroring those older styles of writing and thinking like, oh, you know, what would the music have sounded like that accompanied this?
Yeah, well, think about how we just introduced this podcast. I'm sure that, you know, Psalm 23 doesn't sound very much like Gangster's Paradise, but Coolio made it work.
Yeah, I'm imagining it kind of has a Arabic string instruments in the background, harps or sitars, if they had those.
Well, you can look at some of the translations, too. I think it's a Psalterion is like a Greek word for like a five-stringed instrument or something. Or, yeah, I'm not sure now.
It's interesting because like when I was a younger heathen in 2014, I went to Bonnaroo, which is a four-day music festival in Tennessee, and I distinctly recall the point in time during like day one where I was like, wow, I could sit here cross-legged and not move and be at complete peace. And I'm in this national park with 80,000 people and 12 stages, and there's music and sound and jubilee all around me. And, you know, reflecting post having exposed myself to Psalms, I'm like, oh, this was almost a religious experience. And I say almost because it was devil's worship, obviously. And I wouldn't have had this stance until I got into the Psalms, but it's like literally like I had a corrupted religious experience because there's so much music, there's so much ritual, there's so much ceremony, and you don't really understand what's going on, but your body is like, yeah, this is right. This is peak human experience. We should be feeding each other and singing and being good. And that's not quite what was happening at a music festival. And I get it now, you know, the decades of rock music resisting the Christian oppression of devil's music. It's like, no, like it really is devil's music. If you're not going to church to sing and you're not scheduling that worship in that way, you're still whatever you eat, but now you've exposed yourself to the pantheon of musical influence and lyrical implication. And all of a sudden you've got, I don't know what you just said, Scott, but the word kill was in the band, right? And it's like, you're now consuming lyrics that your unconscious mind is processing. And it's saying, oh, maybe I do need hoes and money and cars. And now it's looking for hoes and money and cars. But if you don't have that exposure to rock and roll and rap and death metal and all of these things, and you just have your religious music, then for that 7-day stretch in between Sunday, your unconscious mind has consumed the fruits of doing good work and doing God's mission and staying on track. And if you don't have that, you have whatever the heck it is you're consuming for 7 days. And I get it. I totally get why it's still today happening. People are saying, look, this is devil's worship. This is not helping you because it's confusing. You know, the human brain has a hard time processing all of this stuff. And the less input you have, the more reliable your output's going to be. You know, you reduce the variables that go into your machine, you're going to be able to closer guarantee the output. And that's why you look at the Mennonite model that says we're not even going to be near society because there's too much temptation. We're not even going to consider painting our bedrooms a different color because it's too much temptation. If you have a controlled amount of variables, you can generally and reliably predict the results. And in the world we live in now and the freedoms we have religiously speaking, you have so many options, and it's a great world. There's lots of benefits to it. There's tons of opportunity and abundance, but it's much easier to get lost and stuck in the mire. And we see that, you know, we have this meaning crisis. We have this opioid epidemic. We have suicide problems. And it's like, well, why is that? Well, we don't have a good community. We don't have proper supports. We don't have the structure that you would have had 3,000 years ago at the walls of Jericho with your trombones blasting down the walls, because we have so many options that you have people saying, oh, I don't know what I'm supposed to do with my life. I don't know who I'm supposed to be. I don't know what I'm supposed to have.
Like, through all this freedom that we've gotten, like freedom from scripture, we've lost our focus, kind of thing.
Yeah.
Like we have the freedom to make songs about, you know, making cars, getting laid, and, you know, everything else, just making money and focusing on hedonistic pleasures. And that's taken away our ability to reach transcendence. It's a distraction. I think it's pretty problematic to start like censoring these things. But I think it does make it more difficult to focus on, like, what's good when there's so much more of, like, just, like, the meaningful versus expedient thing, you know, that Jordan Peterson talks about. Like, there's so many expedient pleasures that the meaningful ones are literally hidden from us. Where back in the day when all they had were these psalms, every like expedient like musical pleasure was like bringing them closer to their God.
Yeah, exactly. And Will, I don't mean to cut you off, but I'm really glad you brought up that point, kind of the qualia of the music, if you could call it that. Because, these psalms taken with the dialect they would have been sung in, and the musical instruments, I think their purpose, like you mentioned, Sky, is to bring you closer to God. Because there are numerous times throughout these books where David himself is kind of questioning, where God is. God, could you please lend your ear to me?
Right.
And I think the ritual of the singing brings you, or maybe it brings God's attention to you, or connects you in some sort of spiritual way that you were cut off without that music.
Yeah, see, as an atheist, I would say it just like strengthens your focus. It like allows you to just, I don't know, like I can recognize that I don't believe in like whatever God these people believe in, but I recognize and understand that the effect that they're getting closer to God. Does that make any sense? 'Cause like it like that whole scenario, that whole landscape, that relationship, it all exists up here. Whether the God is real or not, it only exists within the person. Because how else would you like communicate with such an entity or figure? I don't
Well,
know what
it's
I'm
like
trying
if
to
a tree
say.
falls in a forest and no one's there, it doesn't make a sound, right? Like if a God exists in a universe, but there's no human to perceive it, is it real? But
Right.
it's like to go back to censorship, right? Like I don't think we should censor anything, but it's one thing to not censor anything, and it's another thing to just let the sheep run wild in the field and not tell them, that a knife is a knife and that a pillow is a pillow. And
Right.
I think that that's kind of what's been happening for a few decades, where it's like, okay, well, you have your choice. You can either be religious or not. You can go to church or not. You can worship in your own way. But we're not explaining to children that, we've known that minor chords make you sad for thousands of years. We
Right.
know that major chords are uplifting. We know that if you do something in specific rhythms, it makes the body feel a certain way. And we might not have had the scientific explanation for it up until recently, and we may not still be all the way there, but that level of awareness and that level of freedom didn't prevent me from, consuming mass amounts of minor chord themed music when I was 13 years old, thinking that life was hard and I was sad and heartbroken, Like we could give people instructions as to how these things work and how the mind processes reality instead of just saying, look, don't do that. It's like, look, when you do this, this will happen because that's how your brain is structured, that's how your body is structured. And it's very hard to do that, to instruct, a growing human, because for the first 7 years, maybe they'll absorb everything you tell them, and then after that, they'll hit the rebel phase, and it's like you're lucky if anything sinks in. And I was having this conversation last week with someone about, they were saying, propaganda is manipulative. And I was like, yeah, well, that's a cop out, right? Because all of human existence is manipulative, and manipulation has got a bad rap. We handle humans. That's what manipulation means. It's French in its earliest etymology, right? Manipuler. And you use your hands to manipulate objects, and you use your teachings to manipulate or handle children. And you want to be manipulated by all of human experience, because if we weren't, we wouldn't have all of our instincts, and we wouldn't have all of our intuitions, and we wouldn't evolve, right? We would die of exposure 15,000 years ago if we weren't learning from those around us. And it gets to a bad place when you start censoring people and preventing them from being able to handle all of that. And you need to be able to give humans tools to understand things. And like we throw so much out with the bathwater, like the whole notion of arbitrary holidays. Like Valentine's Day just passed, and I had someone on Facebook talking about how manipulative and shallow and corporate and blah, 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 you should just love your loved ones every day of the year. And it's like, no, hold on. This is unifying, right? This has been around for 1800 years. And on this day, every year, out of the 365 days of a year, we get to say, you know what? A lot of people on the world are thinking about love today. What does that mean to me? How do I love myself? How do I love my friends? How do I love my loved ones? And what can I do about it? How can I express it? And at a young age, you're instructed that, look, you can write them a card. You can get them a gift. You can tell them that you think they're important today. And in fact, we'll all do it. And that is just like going to church and singing, you know, having a holiday, a corporate holiday, where we're able to go into the market and experience the miracle of human achievement, of the dyes that we have amassed from all over the world, and the fancy printing processes that we have developed over thousands of years of compounding human innovation to be able to celebrate the human experience. And if you get rid of all of that and you say, no, you should just be loving every day, then it turns into this gray yogurt existence that is just all the same all the time. And it's miserable. And you know, you march towards a communist dystopian society.
I hate it when that happens. Yeah.
The worst.
Yeah, just to go back a little bit to what you said, you really have to like take a second look at the language we use sometimes. Like I remember when Jordan Peterson was talking about like suffering something, like to suffer something is just to undergo it. And you could say like to manipulate something is simply just to interact with something. Because if you interact with anything, you're going to manipulate it somehow by the definition that you just gave. So, like, to say that we're manipulated by the books that we read or, you know, scripture or church, well, of course we are. We're manipulated by everything. As soon,
Exactly.
with every breath you take, there's something manipulating your lungs right now.
Well, you were saying that it's important to kind of know how to love somebody, and I think it's helpful to be manipulated or to experience, you know, what it means to hate somebody as well. Kind of going back to the knowledge of good and evil. If you know both good and evil, and you choose to do the good, that's the meek thing to do, the righteous thing to do. And that's one of the major themes that I saw in this book, you know, extolling the righteous and particularly pointing out the attributes of the wicked, being things like taking advantage of the needy, or very specifically lying, so not telling the truth, which is a very prominent aspect of the Zoroastrian religion. I know we weren't going to read a bunch out of Psalms, but there was this one part from Psalm 14 that I thought was kind of related to what we're talking about here, where he says, David says, "The fool says in his heart, there is no God. They are corrupt and they do abominable deeds. There is none who does good." And I think it's because when you forget the difference between good and evil, you're bound to do something that's evil and not even realize it, right?
There's a lot to unpack there. You know, like, so if you don't know what evil is, how good can you really be? But beyond that,
Yeah,
like,
at that point, any time that you were good, it would just be by luck and chance if you weren't getting it from the Bible. I think that's the Christian opinion, right?
yeah, if you didn't
Well,
know the difference, it would just be a chance happenstance.
and it's like, you know, if you're an atheist and bad things happen to you, then you say, oh, well, that's just life and sometimes bad things happen to me. Or maybe you're depressed and you beat yourself up and you take full responsibility for it. Maybe you're not even depressed. Maybe you're just highly disciplined and have a strong sense of self-responsibility. And you say, oh, this is my fault. Good. I can work on these problems. But like, it's almost, it's narcissistic at that point, where if you're just taking responsibility for all the good and the bad that happens to you, and then you kind of, you could get caught up in your own ego there. But when you have God as the highest form of credit, I think that there's a bit more empowerment to that. You know, like if God gives you hard things, then he's the one, or she's the one, or they're the one that know that you're capable of dealing with it. And when you do get the good things, it's more of a reward. I think it's just an extra layer of oxytocin and dopamine and serotonin when you throw God into the mix, you know? Like, I just feel like it expands how great things can be and how terrible things can be too, as we see in the book of Job. I don't know really where I'm going with that, but I'll run away to a different topic. Well, and I had a conversation.
You could always, like, if you have that fallback, if you have that, like, worldview that God is responsible for everything, the good and the bad, you can always fall back on, like, well, this is all part of his plan and this will all pass. And I could see how that would get you through it. Of just, like, faith in, like, the plan, saying, like, well, I believe in God. I've always been a good Christian. I'm just walking a couple steps in Job's shoes right now. He's testing me, and then I can go on to, like, reach higher things or go on to the rest of my life or whatever he has planned for me, that's what I'll go do. And, like, having that mindset can definitely get you through a tragedy easier than, God damn it, the world is just torturing me. Like,
you can't even scorn the world without bringing God into it. Oh, God damn it, that was your atheistic pitch. God damn it, the world is just scorning me.
I'm pretty sure we've established that, you know, like, atheists like myself, like, something fills the God hole. I have no idea what it is. As far as I can tell, it's just the world and environment and every single human being that inhabits it. That's my God.
Well, I want to talk about hate for a minute, because big problems I have with religion, I think, is like this notion that I have experienced or come to feel is the way it is that, you know, if your religion X,
the us versus them.
Yeah, it's like everybody should be on board with our religion, with our God. And
it's preposterous.
You know, when you go through the Old Testament, you see a lot of wars being fought over it. And, you know, when you talk about hatred, I feel like it's almost like a hopeless love, because you're still fixated on changing someone. And if you want to focus on someone, that is love. I don't care how hateful you are about it, because there's neutral. That's an option too. And if you can't figure out how to evolve the thing that you're fixated on, I think you resort to destruction. And you say, look, I can't love this, it can't grow, so I'll hate it and I'll destroy it, because then the world will be a better place. And it's still got this positive secondary gain. And it's hard to evolve hate, or to transmogrify or to alchemize hate into love, without a God and a religious worldview that has infinite hope and faith for the transcendence of evil things.
Mm.
You know, barring any incredibly debilitating mental states, there's no reason for a human to not be able to learn to conceptualize of a good way to live in harmony with its surroundings.
Yeah, I think what you're talking about is intolerance rather than hate. I think that's a better word to use there. Unless you think there really is a hatred and a vitriol between... I guess there is.
I don't know. You know, like, this last year has really tested me. I've spent a very large amount of my adult life believing that there isn't truly evil in this world, and that people really do things from a place of good intention, but when it finally trickles out into action, you know, it goes through the layers of their perception and conceptualization, and they do some awful things. But it's hard for me to believe that a human with a functioning brain that isn't beleaguered by disease and mental handicap would actually do bad things. You know, it's hard for me to picture that there's a rational corporate giant who legitimately thinks that he should take advantage of poor people. You know, I think that perhaps there's some laziness involved where they say, look, they don't even know how to take care of themselves. And if I do it this way, even though the world perceives it as bad, it's going to result in a net improvement. And, you know, in the last year, I've started to question that. And I don't know. Are there evil people that want to be evil, that are comfortable with committing tragedy?
Well, I think that the evil people justify it. I think they have zero problem taking money away from poor people and food out of the mouths of the hungry if they can justify it in their own head and saying, well, I'm actually helping people by being more and more rich and successful. I'm more important than these individuals, so I should be propped up. They weren't going to accomplish anything anyway, so, you know,
and
to hell with
it. Circles
them.
Back like to
the Jim
conversations
the Jim Taggart mentality is real, man. Like, I don't think they wake up in the morning, set out to do evil things, but they do evil things and then justify them as good.
But forget Jim Taggart. It's the Francisco D'Anconia mentality. Because if you sink a ship with... Ragnar, you know, going out shipping or sinking ships that are bringing supplies because they're saying, look, this isn't a sustainable method and this isn't how it should be done. Like, it's still a bad thing, but he's got the super intelligence. He's the Superman, and he's the one who knows the direction the world actually needs to go. And it's easy to get lost in this train of thought.
So there's kind of a dualism that I've noticed in the Bible, because we have these praises of man for his God, and they extol God's love for man, but it is a very select group of men that God loves, right? Because if you remember back, well, God's also described as quite angry and manifests as lightning and can destroy things too, right? So if you go back to like Numbers, the same God that David's praising here is telling his generals basically they didn't kill enough people and they need to go back and kill every man and every non-virgin woman and take every virgin woman for themselves. And it's kind of like, you know, that's
like the most human part of every religion, as far as I can tell, because they all have a god that has chosen them as a people. Go back to the Aegeans, like sacking Troy. You know, Zeus chose them. That's why they succeeded. The same thing is in the Bible. The same thing is in nearly every religious text that I've ever been exposed to.
It may be to instill fear in the believers in a way that, you know, if you choose not to follow the air quote righteous path, that the same God is going to cut you down as well.
That sounds more like a religious leader saying, hey, if you join the other team, our God is going to kill you himself.
Yeah, exactly.
And that just feeds into the us versus them element of organized religion that, you know, I have a personal problem with, and it sounds like Will has a personal problem with.
But it's complicated, right? Because it's a chicken and the egg situation, right? Like, can the human species exist without an us versus them? And, you know, and that's the thing that I've been experiencing and learning over the last year. You know, you talk about politics with somebody who doesn't agree with your political stance, and you find out just how quickly you can get polarized in your view. And it's like, is there any merit to having an open dialogue with someone who just diametrically opposes what it is that you believe the world should be and what the world should look like? And, you know, like we had a conversation a couple of years ago about Nestle and the water bottling situation. So many people are ready to say, oh, Nestle's evil because they're taking Canada's spring water and they're barely even paying anything for it and they're bottling it and they're selling it back to us at a profit. And, you know, the CEO of Nestle comes out and he says, look, you don't get it. A hurricane hits New Orleans and they've got no water. They've got no clean water. And we have funneled tax money into a government that can now allocate an emergency fund to acquire resources. Well, guess what? If you don't have bottled water, you're not allocating bottled water to a crisis, because how are you going to do it? You can pick it up with your hands and go on a plane? No, you need bottled water. And if you want bottled water, you need infrastructure. And if you want infrastructure, you need corporation. Because when the government does it, it gets weird. And when private corporations do it, it gets weird too. But I think I'd rather a private corporation that's got competition do it, because they're going to do it to make it as profitable and as painless as possible. But the problem happens when you look at, you know, China. Right behind the snow hills of the Olympics, you've got 1,000 nuclear reactors and just unmitigated, you know, progress. And you have 1,000 towns in China that none of us have ever heard the name of. And they've got over 1 million people living in them. And one town makes bags. And we buy their bags. And those bags end up in the ocean. And we don't care, because we need a bag. Because a bag is a very useful tool. And it's great. Like, there's so much happening at so many levels. And it's so easy to say, oh, this is evil. And this is good. And it's like, nothing is that black and white when it's that simplified. Because everything's black and white. I don't think there's any such thing as a gray area. But the problem is, when you look at the mosaic of the human experience, the black and white blends together. And you get this perception of a gray area that I think a lot of people try and take advantage of. And sweep issues under the rug with that as the excuse.
Yeah. I'm gonna pull a Jason here and reference Genesis again. But I think this calls back to the Tower of Babel. And like, when you're talking about like the left and the right not being able to understand each other, the Christians and the atheists not being able to understand each other, as soon as you get like two political people that disagree with each other, they start talking about bringing out guillotines and starting a civil war and everything. And like, well, let's just break down the tower and go our separate ways. Maybe that's the right idea.
And it's like, we know that it's not, right? Like, we know that a diversity of opinions leads to an abundance of opportunities.
Yeah. But it's,
and so it's hard.
It's
and
a that's struggle. Why that's like our that's generation, the thing. Yeah.
Our generation has learned in the last year that this is why the adage of you talk about weather and sports, right? Like, you don't talk about politics and religion, because people haven't had the time to even assess their beliefs, but their beliefs are who they are. And when you make them question their beliefs, they get really angry really quickly.
Yeah, well, kind of going back to the us versus them thing, I think that's relatively easy to understand coming from like a tribal mindset. You know, you have one tribe that maybe wants to come and take your land. So, you know, it is a us versus them back in that period where we had a bunch of tribes. But now with the globalization of the world, it is more of a the us versus them aspect, I think, is lessened to some extent. But one of the themes from this book, you know, is that you got to be wary about putting your trust in man and kings and governments, because they can easily become corrupt. And so I think the idea behind this book is, put your faith in this one God and be wary of other gods and other idols, and be wary of kings, right?
Well, it's almost like, for me, I see like there's this conflict of natural law and social contract, where At the beginning of the morning, natural law says you can do whatever you want. And then the social contract says we'd like you to not. Because naturally, you could pick up a weapon and you could go murder people. And that is true freedom. But the social contract of a society says we don't do that anymore because we've established our societies and we're going to get along. And we'd like to observe natural laws respect to rights. And we'd also like to create social contracts that afford us certain freedoms. And so there's this huge camp of people that say everyone deserves a home, clean water, 3 square meals a day, heat, education, freedom of mobility around the planet, all of these different things. It's like, at the beginning of the day, none of that is afforded to you, right? If you strip away all of the social contracts, all of the society, what you have is a bunch of people naked and afraid, starving and dying of exposure. But because of the social contracts that we've built over these thousands of years, we've created upward mobility in the class structure and the capitalist society structure that allows you to exchange your time, your energy, your body for certain rewards. And then you get into these discussions with people who are living this life and they say, well, this doesn't make me happy. And it's like, well, hold on. Who said anything about being happy? Who said there was any point to life? Who said there was any merit to being happy? And what about fulfillment? And what about survival? And what about expression for expression, right? So that a human who isn't harming others, but might be harming themselves or might not be bettering themselves, is entitled to their existence, right? The drug addict or the high-functioning alcoholic that gets through their work week and provides money and resources to their family and maintains, you know, they have their maintenance existence, and 10 years down the line their station hasn't been improved, but perhaps they procreated, perhaps they haven't, you know, they've experienced life, and that should be accepted and permissible. But then there's this whole camp of people that say, no, we need to be better, or no, we need to be more free, no, we need to be more successful, we need to be more educated. And it's like, no, you're entitled to exist. That's the whole deal. Life is just life. And who's to say how it should be lived? Because in a million years, none of it matters.
Yeah, that reminds me of like a moment in the last Jordan Peterson, Joe Rogan podcast. You guys watch that one?
I missed it.
That 5-hour one, you mean?
Yeah, I was close. But there was like a little clip from it where it was like Jordan was saying like, okay, let's play a game. You can do anything in this game. You go first. Exactly. Without the limitations, if you had a chessboard in front of you, you'd know like, oh, I'll move my pawn two spaces forward. If there was like a basketball court, I'd know I'd start dribbling and try to get it in the hoop. But if we're playing a game where it's just, you can do anything in this game, go ahead. You go first.
It's like, well, what do I do?
Everyone does what
people done.
Yeah, everyone does what you just did. Stand there, just sit there and look at me.
Yeah, like, there was an anthropology experiment where they gave African children just crayons and said, draw anything you want. And most of them, they were like, oh, I don't know what to draw. But if you told them, I want you to draw a giraffe, it would draw something that approximated a giraffe. Do you think, though, that for for an atheist, these social rules that we are supposed to adhere to, is that similar to like being righteous for a religious person?
Well, it's hard to discern those things because really I inherited it all from Christianity, didn't I? Like I grew up in a westernized, Christianized country, even if it wasn't, you know, overtly Christian at the time, we're still dealing with the same kind of like, all our laws came from the Bible, if you True, really okay. break it down. Like, the Magna Carta was really religious, and that's kind of the founding element of all of the like the British colonies that became countries.
Yeah, I noticed this one quote from Psalm 56 that we find it on the American dollar bill, "In God I trust." They changed it to "In God we trust," of course.
Yeah. Create like a unity for the people. If you all believe the same thing, if you all believe that we all trust in God, then it kind of brings people together a little bit better, I would think. Write it on your money so you can't help but, you know, read it every day.
Yeah, what's kind of significant about that is when we write it on our money, the money is really kind of a promise to the future that we'll continue trusting in this God, right?
It's interesting. It's like you need to establish things. And if you don't establish things, there's like you said with that anthropology experiment, there's nothing, like you don't know what to do. You have to have structure. You have to have restrictions.
And that works in
so that
like
they
can
be rebelled against even. Right? Yeah. Like rules were made to be broken, you know, and that's the thing when you talk about is an atheist righteous in the religious sense when they do what they need to do in society? And it's like, well, certain religions throughout the history of society have rejected the laws of society and said, no, we need a new order. And that's kind of all of the human experience, is getting to a place of understanding that gives you the supervision of the establishment to say, oh, this isn't working for me anymore. You know, like, it's so hard because every time a year goes by, you conceptualize more. And it makes me think of that. You always see it on social media. You know, you have a red pill and a blue pill. The red pill, you keep all of your memories and you start over at age 5. The blue pill, you get $10 million. And I see so many people say, oh, absolutely, I want the red pill. I want to know everything I know now and start over at age 5. And it's like, you could never be a 5-year-old and conceive of everything you've conceived of. Like, are we talking memories of heartbreak? Could you imagine being 5 years old and remembering what it felt like to have true love and then be heartbroken, to hate the 9-to-5 grind? That would be, you would literally be a sociopath, because it would be so easy to play the entire world into your favor when you're dealing with a classroom of 5-year-olds with the memories of a 26-to-50-year-old.
I think I think it would break a 5-year-old if he was just, you know, staying up all night thinking about, you know, that time he got shot down by that girl when he was 20 years old.
Like, you would have so much authority and confidence, and it would drive you nuts, and you still wouldn't get what you wanted because nobody would be on your level. You still wouldn't be able to navigate these situations. You wouldn't even be able to feel the feeling you felt at that point, because no one would even conceptualize what you've conceived. And
it's possible it would change your priorities completely, radically. Like, if you went back in time somehow, I'm assuming, and knowing everything you know now, you could make a lot more wise investments, for example, in things and money, and you might not focus so much on investments and people.
Yeah. But I don't know, it's odd. And I think that we're still growing and evolving and getting to that point where we want to tear down the establishment because we think we understand what would work better. But I see, it's like, again, with that game with no rules, it's like, well, what do you do? And it's like, well, the first thing I'd want to do is see what everyone else has ever done. And because once I know what everyone else has done, then I can actually make a good inferential guess as to what to do next. But You see people trying to tear down the establishment, and they don't know that this has been done every 100 years for the last 5,000 years. And it's like, to what end? Because we've seen the cyclical course that revolution takes. Like, I mean, it's inherent in the term. Revolution does not mean anything new. It's literally a revolution of a circle. Like, but you also don't want to reinvent the wheel, because the wheel is very smooth surface on which to roll down a hill. Or to drive up a hill.
Yeah, these are all important points. Like, the don't throw the baby out with the bathwater.
And so we return to singing and to songs. And I ask you and all listening, if you haven't read the Bible, are you even trying? Because you can do it way quicker than us. We're on year 3, marching through the analysis of the Bible. But you can spend 20 minutes reading the first book of the Old Testament and discover that you're living in a society that's been repeating its mistakes for thousands of years.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, that might be a good point to conclude for today. We're only, like, in... book, I think, what, 90 of Psalms, so we are going to pick this up. And
we're all at different points in the book, so like I said, we'll revisit it again, hopefully with some extra people.
Yeah, for a book club, we spend a lot of time on different pages, right?
Yeah. With that said, may the force be with you,
or equal to mass times acceleration.
Have a good one.